Today is Wednesday, June 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A leading disease expert in the U.S. says that time is of the essence to address rising numbers of COVID-19.
Right now, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical in our ability to address those surgings.
Plus, the EU says it will move forward with creating a digital tax.
There is this strong push to be able to set boundaries.
And the UN is calling on parties to stop fighting in Yemen. We'll have those stories and more next. The total number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 has surpassed 9.25 million people worldwide, according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. Brazil has over 1.1 million cases, but the United States continues to lead the world as the nation approaches 2.5 million cases. In Africa, the World Health Organization said as of Wednesday, all of the continent's 54 nations had lab testing capabilities. In Asia, the daily number of new coronavirus cases in Tokyo climbed to 55, the highest daily tally in 1.5 months, after a cluster of infections was found at an office in the Japanese capital. Tokyo has said it could reimpose restrictions if new cases crept up to 50 or more. Australia's military was called in on Wednesday to help tackle a coronavirus outbreak in Melbourne, a surge in infections that has rattled the country's second most populous city. The federal government has offered the Army support to respond to the virus outbreak, while four other states have also offered to help with contact tracing. Australia recorded its first COVID-19 death in a month, with a man in his 80s dying in Victoria. In Washington, Dr. Anthony Fauci, one of the country's top public health experts, on Tuesday told a House of Representatives committee that time is of the essence as cases in the U.S. continue to climb.
Right now, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical in our ability to address those surgings that we're seeing in Florida, in Texas, in Arizona, and in other states. They're not the only ones that are having a difficulty. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, it's a mixed bag. Some good and some now we have a problem with.
During his testimony, the disease expert said he felt cautiously optimistic about finding a COVID-19 vaccine, possibly by the start of 2021. VOA Russian service reporter Anush Avechsian recently spoke to Catherine O'Brien via Skype. Now, she's the WHO Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals, and they discussed the importance of finding a vaccine for the novel coronavirus.
Well, we don't really have viruses that simply die out, except for some of the coronaviruses that we've had before, where they've circulated in only very small communities or small populations. They haven't been worldwide pathogens. So we're not really sure what's going to happen with this pathogen. And certainly all of the efforts that are being made to contain the pathogen, to make sure that it's circulating in only, you know, very small amounts, all of those efforts that are being done by countries to really constrain this pathogen mean that there's an ever greater chance that it's going to have less and less of an effect on populations. But that's totally dependent on the degree to which the interventions that we have already and the degree to which treatments, diagnostics, and vaccines can actually control the pandemic.
And what about the safety of the vaccine? Is it possible to develop safe vaccine in such short period of time?
In developing any vaccine, and certainly for COVID vaccine, there's going to be no compromising on the safety. The reason that we're able to go more quickly is, first of all, because there's a substantial amount of funding that's being put towards developing COVID vaccines. And so many more candidates are coming into clinical trials more quickly than ever before for vaccine development. And secondly, we're using the opportunity to, in fact, design clinical trials in new ways so that we move from one stage very quickly to the next stage. And in some ways, this is really driven by the interest of all countries to have a vaccine as quickly as possible. So the steps involved are really moving from one step right to the next step as quickly as possible. But this will not compromise, and there's no negotiating on the degree of safety assessment and on the rigor around safety assessments that are being done.
And how do we make sure that eventually everyone gets vaccine? Is there such a plan how to distribute vaccine and who will be first to get it? Is it like more younger people or opposite, people who are in risk groups?
So WHO is working very carefully on an allocation framework. And the allocation framework is really based on the principles of access. Access should be driven by public health goals and what is required to achieve the end to this pandemic. And so an allocation framework that uses the evidence on the distribution of this virus around the world, the timing of the virus, and looks at who are the groups of people who are most at risk of the most severe outcomes. Death, of course, is probably the most important, and severe illness would be in that category also. So we're looking at very carefully at the data and at the evidence around which groups those are, which groups of people, and those would be the people that we would prioritize for vaccination, given that at the beginning of the development of vaccine and manufacturing of vaccine, there will be a limitation of supply. And as time goes on, the number of doses that are produced will increase substantially and greater numbers of people can be vaccinated. But we really should start from the principle of what will be needed in order to control the pandemic and eventually to end the pandemic. And I think what's clear from the evidence is that is unlikely to require immunizing everybody in every country. The ways in which the pandemic could be controlled through the use of the vaccine, along with diagnostics, treatment, and the kinds of public health measures that we've been using, which is to identify cases, understand who they've been in contact with, have people quarantine and be tested over a period of time when they might then develop signs or symptoms of the illness, and we can identify whether they've actually been infected.
Catherine O'Brien is the WHO Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals, and she was speaking to VOA Russian service reporter Anush Avechsian. The International Monetary Fund has sharply lowered its forecast for global growth this year because it expects far more severe economic damage from the coronavirus than it did just 2 months ago. The IMF predicts that the global economy will shrink nearly 5% this year, significantly worse than the 3% drop it had estimated in April. It would be the worst annual contraction since immediately following World War II. Now, for the United States, the IMF predicts that the nation's gross domestic product, the value of all goods and services produced, will drop 8%, compared with its earlier estimate of a 5.9% fall. Such a decline would be the worst for the United States since it demobilized after World War II. Across the Atlantic, the European Union says it is willing to move forward without a global consensus on a new digital tax. European Commission Executive Vice President Marguerite Vestager made that statement on Tuesday. I spoke with journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris via WhatsApp to learn how the EU will move forward after the United States pulled out of talks last week.
Well, you know, she said that she would rather have a consensus with the United States. But right now, the current situation doesn't allow the situation to move on and to find that middle ground with Washington. So as she said, she would really prefer global consensus on digital tax. But anyway, if there's no consensus, she will go ahead with this tax. And we have to remember, there's a huge push from the French government. If you remember the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, he said it's so difficult to defend many, many businesses all over the world who don't pay taxes, such as the GAFA. He would mention, for example, Google, Apple, or Facebook, or Amazon, for example. So on the French side and globally on the European side, there is this strong push to be able to set boundaries for these huge tech companies to be able to pay taxes within the countries where they make businesses, and not only in the United States where they originated. That's the point of view from the European. You have to remember that Margaret Vestager, her title, and I quote, is Executive Vice President of the European Commission for a Europe Fit for the Digital Age. She's really moving forward besides the legal aspect And the current fight with Washington is really trying to move ahead for the European continent to be able to be at the vanguard of the digital age.
So, I mean, really quickly now, what does she see as her next steps moving forward to achieve her goal?
Well, as of right now, she's going to consult with all the, you know, European members, European states. But basically, they want to set this EU-wide digital services tax and minimum tax on multinationals by 2021. I mean, it's very, very soon.
That's only a half year away.
Exactly. And they have everything ongoing. And if you remember what the EU commissioner for economy, the Italian Paolo Gentiloni, said, we need to be ambitious on taxation and we should not be prevented by Washington to go ahead. So the position from the European members is that they had enough talks, they gave enough time for the OECD, which was leading the talks with Washington on this digital tax.
Speaking of the OECD, you know, talks broke down between the United States and the OECD over this effort. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin actually pulled Washington out of the discussion. So can you kind of walk us through what exactly led to that?
Well, basically, you have this position by the U.S. administration that they don't want any tax on digital services. So, of course, with the pressure of the European Union, they came to an agreement that it was time to talk. And Steven Mnuchin, he gave that time and for some talks that was organized by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. But when the talks stopped last week, Steven Mnuchin, he said in a letter sent to the finance minister of the UK, France, Spain, and Italy that the US was unable to agree even on an interim basis on changes of the global taxation law. So basically, the idea of taxing US tech companies, because most of them, maybe 95% of them, are from based in the United States, it's a no-go for them. There's no way they would accept what he called that distraction from far more important matters. So on the other side, you have also the threat from Washington that if such a tax is imposed on U.S. tech companies, you might have some trade tariff, and especially on French goods such as cheese, champagne, and also Washington threatens to launch federal investigation on some French companies.
Nicolas Pinault lives and works in Paris, France. U.S. President Donald Trump's brother is asking a New York City judge to block a tell-all book about the family from being published. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has the details.
The book, entitled Too Much and Never Enough, was written by President Trump's niece, Mary Trump. The description says it contains stories of the family patterns that, quote, created the damaged man who currently occupies the Oval Office. Robert Trump, the president's brother, filed court papers to block the release of the book. He argues Mary Trump and others signed a settlement agreement many years ago that included a confidentiality clause and an agreement not to publish their stories. The settlement related to the will of Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump, a New York real estate developer. Mary Trump's book is due to be released later this month. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And coming up later,
I don't think that we can say it stops at Taiwan and that's it. There's certainly some signaling to the U.S. as well. Anything they can do to try to signal to the U.S. that it should not be getting as cozy with Taiwan as it has been in the last few years, that's an important thing.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
When a more massive star dies, its core collapses from tremendous gravity and forms a black hole. A star with less mass explodes in a supernova and becomes a neutron star. Scientists at the U.S. LIGO and Italy's Virgo collaborations have detected what they describe as an unusual gravitational wave signal. They say the signal was generated by the merger of a 2.6 solar mass object with a 23 solar mass black hole. The reason for the uncertainty of the first object was that it had a mass between the heaviest known neutron star, 2.5 solar masses, and the lightest known black hole, 5 solar masses. The scientists are trying to determine if the object was now the heaviest neutron star or the lightest black hole known to science. Details of the discovery were published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. North Korea has decided to suspend military action plans against South Korea. Pyongyang's official state media suggested North Korean troops were taking down loudspeakers recently installed at the fortified border. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
The report said that the day before, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made an appearance, presiding over a video conference meeting. He, quote, took stock of the prevailing situation before deciding to suspend military plans. Meanwhile, a South Korean report said North Korean troops were taking down giant loudspeakers near the Korean border. Only this week, video showed those speakers being reinstalled at the demilitarized zone. In the past, the speakers would blare propaganda aimed at the South, but many were taken down when the two Koreas signed a 2018 peace accord. It all marks a step back from a recent spike in tension between both sides. Last week, North Korea blew up a liaison office on its side of the border. Pyongyang has also made vocal objections to groups led by North Korean defectors in the South. The groups plan to send anti-North Korean leaflets by balloon over the border. The North said the campaign insults the dignity of Kim Jong-un and breaches their 2018 peace agreement. One group, the Fighters for Free North Korea, told Reuters they sent off 20 balloons carrying leaflets and dollar bills on Monday. South Korea's unification ministry said Wednesday they were monitoring the situation closely.
The government's original stance that inter-Korean agreements must be kept remains unchanged.
The ministry added that activities that may cause tension between the two Koreas, including releasing leaflets, would be, quote, sternly dealt with.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. An investigation into the Pakistan airliner that crashed and killed 97 people last month near Karachi has found that its pilots and air traffic control officials did not follow set procedures. An aviation minister said the pilots were not focused because of the coronavirus pandemic, although the aircraft was 100% fit. Flight PK-8303 from the eastern city of Lahore came down about a kilometer short of the runway on its second attempt to land. U.S. Prosecutor Aaron Zelensky is planning to tell the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee today there was heavy pressure on prosecutors in the case of Roger Stone, a friend of President Trump, to ease their sentencing recommendation. He has said the pressure came from the highest levels of the Department of Justice. Zelensky, who withdrew from the Roger Stone case in protest, will add that Tim Shea, the acting U.S. attorney at the time, ultimately caved into pressure because he was afraid of the president. Republicans are expected to push back on his testimony, saying he is confusing politicization with policy disagreements. Iran's president has warned the UN nuclear watchdog to expect a stern response from his country regarding the agency's demands for access to sites where Tehran is thought to have stored or used undeclared nuclear material. Despite the warning, President Hassan Rouhani said the country prefers cooperation with the UN watchdog. The remarks reflect Tehran's irritation at a resolution adopted last week by the board of the International Atomic Energy Agency demanding access to the sites. Germany, France, and Britain backed the resolution, while Russia and China voted against it. The United Nations chief is calling for more pressure to be applied to Yemen's warring parties to come together to arrange a ceasefire. The war has cost more than 10,000 lives and displaced 2 million people in the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Yemeni people are suffering terribly and COVID-19 is worsening their situation. Roughly 280,000 refugees from Africa live in Yemen, and they are among the poorest, most vulnerable people in the world. Aid organizations say during this pandemic, international resources to support them have dwindled to almost nothing. And families say they are barely surviving, choosing to expose themselves to the virus rather than starve. Heather Murdoch and Nasi Shaker bring us this story.
Imagine living in a place so difficult and dangerous that you feel you have to flee to Yemen, one of the poorest countries in the world, embroiled in a brutal war and plagued with acute malnutrition and diseases like cholera. And then imagine this. As a refugee in Yemen, suddenly everything gets worse. This is Aya Mohammed Osman, a Somali refugee in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. She says since the pandemic began, her mother has been shut out of many of the homes she used to clean. When there is work, Osman says, she worries her mother will be exposed to the coronavirus. But when there is no work, she adds, there is also no food. Yemen has a relatively small number of reported COVID-19 cases, less than 1,000 as of June 23rd. But aid groups say the real number may already be far higher and growing. UNHCR representative in Yemen, Jean-Nicolas Buse, says protecting refugees in Yemen from the virus is nearly impossible.
Indication is that people have difficulties washing their hands regularly because they don't have access to running water. And it's, when they get water, it's not their priority to wash their hands. It's perhaps to cook or something else. The physical distancing is impossible. I mean, it's difficult in those overcrowded neighborhoods or overcrowded houses where different generations live all together.
Yemen hosts the second largest number of Somali refugees in the world after Kenya. And aid workers say the international funds to support some of them are being diverted to other emergency needs as the world's economy reels under the pandemic. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it may soon run out of cash and shelters for refugees and may have to fire about 1,500 local staff at a time when Yemenis are suffering financially. A widespread COVID-19 outbreak here would be disastrous, the organization says. Thousands of hospitals have been destroyed in the war, and there is a severe shortage of even the most basic medical equipment. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Nasi Shaker in Sana'a.
Taiwan says Chinese military planes have flown into its air defense base six times in a single week and eight times this month so far. Taiwan Ministry of Defense jets escort each aircraft away, and the ministry alerts the public of their approach. Some analysts think the leaders in Beijing are warning people as far away as Washington not to meddle in Taiwan, while helping to train their own troops in case a conflict erupts in Asia. Derek Grossman is a senior defense analyst with the RAND Corporation.
I don't think that we can say it stops at Taiwan and that's it. There's certainly some signaling to the U.S. as well. Anything they can do to try to signal to the U.S. that it should not be getting as cozy with Taiwan as it has been in the last few years, that's an important thing.
Domestic news media reported this week that Taiwan has sent Marines to the Pratas Islands, which it controls in the South China Sea, in light of China's movements. China on Wednesday again accused India of provoking a border clash earlier this month that left at least 20 soldiers dead, but urged New Delhi to meet China halfway in restoring peace and stability along their disputed frontier high in the Himalayas. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian offered a longer explanation of China's view of the incident, but gave little new information. He asserted China's claim that the confrontation on June 15th in the Galwan Valley, part of the disputed Ladakh region, occurred on China's side of the control line and Indian forces had illegally entered Chinese territory. Commanders agreed on Monday to disengage their forces in the first meeting since the confrontation. The clash was the deadliest between the two countries in 45 years. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.